From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll explore why parking takes up so much of Milwaukee's downtown area and what could be done to make it more people-friendly. Then, learn how redesigning streets could improve road safety in Milwaukee.
We shouldn't accept a system that we've developed that does result in people dying simply trying to cross the street or simply driving to the grocery store.
Then we go over the current state of the housing market and see if there's any signs of it letting up.
What we were seeing in the market of that lack of inventory and the level of competition and the struggles that buyers have had to have to get a home is something that we have never seen before in our history of real estate.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here's today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. An enormous amount of the downtown Milwaukee area is dedicated to parking. Back in April, Guard PCOR created a diagram comparing where garage and parking lots were located versus park and plaza spaces. PCOR's map spurred conversation questioning how Milwaukee's downtown area could be reimagined to create more people-centered spaces, and how that could be translated across the city. Guard PCOR is a senior market analyst at CoStar Group. He joins Lake Effect's Mallory Chang, and he starts with why we have so much parking in the first place.
We dedicate so much land and resources to our automobile infrastructure and to parking. And as somebody that wants to make Milwaukee a better, more walkable place, you know, more pedestrian friendly, you know, that's definitely one of the biggest issues that we need to target is how much parking we have. And it really is a lot. You know, you look at particularly in the Third Ward, where you have all the parking for Summerfest, the Italian Community Center. We also have a giant parking garage there too. And all that does fill up for big events, but you know, regular weekends, where you see people driving around the Third Ward looking for parking, that parking garage is usually pretty empty. People are looking for that free parking on the weekends and typically aren't really parking in the parking garages. So there's a lot of opportunity in how we value our spaces for pedestrians versus cars and how we can kind of change that moving forward.
Who owns these parking structures, and would it be possible to build something for communal use on top of these places in any time in the immediate future at all?
That's certainly something that's important to look at when we're looking at parking lots and empty lots and parking garages downtown, especially for those that are unfamiliar with real estate. You know, many need to just look at those. Why can't we have an apartment tower here? Why can't we have a hotel here? Something like that. But again, there's a wide variety of entities that own these parking structures and other lots. You know, we have everything from local private investors, maybe they have a small parking business, to institutional investors, national parking firms that are investment trusts that, you know, purchase parking lots, parking garages across the country. We also have a lot of parking garages and parking lots that are tied to office buildings and the owners of those office buildings. And those certainly get heavily used during the day. And it's important to have that parking for offices downtown during the day. We also have some institutions that own parking structures too. You know, the city of Milwaukee, county of Milwaukee own a lot of parking lots and parking structures downtown. You know, some of the schools downtown, MSOE, even the Performing Arts Center has a major parking structure downtown as well, a really prime. So there is definitely a lot of opportunity to build, sort of mixed use developments. I think parking still is an important factor, especially if you're going to be building on top of that. If you're adding 500 apartment units or a major office building on top of a parking structure, that parking is going to be needed to a certain degree. But there is a better way to kind of approach this and try to get more uses out of these certain parcels instead of just a completely dedicated parking use. One thing that I think that the city and other municipal entities have that is a major benefit is that we own, as I said, a lot of these structures, and they can really be a change leader. I think the city of Milwaukee owns, the 5th and Wisconsin parking lot site. I believe it's 6th and State right over by the old Bradley Center. The Milwaukee County owns a parking lot right at the northeast corner of, the whole MacArthur Square courthouse area. A lot of key sites that, we really can enact change. There's another one, a really good one. I think it's 3rd and Michigan, or it's somewhere right around the Foxconn building. There's another site right next to that new hotel that got developed downtown. That's owned by the city as well. And that's a very aging structure. And that's something that the city can look at and say, hey, maybe we can make a better use for this. You know, they have the Housing Authority's development arm, Trouveau. That could be a really great mixed use, sort of affordable housing development. Anything to get more leverage out of that site down there.
Are there any other areas in the city that have as much parking structures or dedicated garage space as downtown or Third Ward or Walker's Point at all?
No, definitely not at the scale that we have downtown and in the downtown area. You know, we do have quite a bit of parking, obviously, around major shopping areas, major shopping centers, industrial parks, business parks as well. The reason we do have so much parking downtown, right, is with urban renewal trends that we saw back in the 50s and 60s and with the freeway getting built, a lot of land was cleared for the freeway and a lot of land was cleared for parking for employees downtown. One of the biggest things that we sort of saw in the mid-20th century when the freeways were getting built was downtowns really went from being, you know, these large congregations of people and as well as businesses. But, you know, we really started to clear people out of our downtowns during that time. You know, you look at the population of Milwaukee from now and compared to back then, we're significantly smaller. And a big part of that is because our urban core has been kind of cleared out of residents.
And as we're moving into the current stage of the COVID-19 pandemic, more businesses are returning to in-person work. Northwestern Mutual, one of them, is a big employer downtown. And I'm sure other employers are following suit. What general downtown real estate trends have you seen lately with people returning to offices?
You know, we are definitely starting to see a bit of an uptick, people returning to the office. So slowly and surely starting to return to sort of full office capacity. But there is the very real reality that hybrid working situations, a bit of mix of working from the office, working remotely, is going to impact office trends downtown. We are seeing, on average, we've seen more leasing activity in the past year than we have in recent years. But also, we've also seen smaller lease deals as well. We've seen a lot of companies downsizing their office spaces. We saw that with Manpower. So it's definitely a trend that we've been seeing with companies sort of right-sizing, making more space-efficient offices for their employees and sort of recognizing that they might not need as much office space as they had in the past.
And it also seems like there's just a lot happening downtown. New developments have been going up, new apartment developments. There's the Third Street Market Hall that opened up. Generally, what trends are we seeing with what's being built in the downtown area?
You know, there's a lot of momentum downtown. Whereas, you know, you look at some of our peer cities, and I always like to take a look at, you know, Chicago, Minneapolis, just two of the closest ones that we have. You know, the trends that we're seeing in downtown Milwaukee are very positive. We're seeing improvement in both the multifamily sector, a lot of apartments getting built, a lot of demand for apartments downtown, and the office as well. There's a lot of companies continuing to move downtown. Milwaukee Tools would be a big addition. Komatsu moving into the downtown area, that's a big addition. You have Right Height. You have a bunch of these major companies that are moving in from the suburbs, seeking out that younger talent that is increasingly choosing to live downtown. So a lot of what has been driving development has been apartment demand, right? We have very, very strong apartment demand downtown. The primary downtown census tract from about Wisconsin Avenue to the tip of Walker's Point, that increased, you know, 70% over the past 10 years. One of the fastest growing census tracts in the state. The Third Ward in particular, back in the 80s, I think there was only about 25 people living in the Third Ward. That's significantly changed during that time. We've seen a renaissance of downtown over the past 10, 20 years or so. And overall, just very, very strong demand for both apartments and new companies looking for that younger talent downtown.
Milwaukee's neighborhoods outside of the downtown area, specifically on the northwest side and the north side, have been historically divested from. And like you just mentioned, a large number of people are moving into the downtown area. Downtown, the Third Ward, Walker's Point, has seen a huge increase in population, while the opposite has been happening in places and areas that are being divested from, such as the north side. And as we see a continual increase investment in the downtown areas, into these downtown areas, how will this continue to affect Milwaukee's neighborhoods? And especially like as we're looking into potentially widening the ramps or fixing the ramps along I-43, which really have went through historically Black and Brown neighborhoods in the city.
You know, it obviously was a huge problem. It, you know, freeways across the country historically went through Black and Brown communities. That's certainly no secret. You know, really decimated the Black economy in Milwaukee, going right through Bronzeville. But one thing with development, and this is where it gets difficult, especially trying to, you know, understand it from an urbanist perspective, where we do need development there, but also coming from the real estate side, where it's very hard to do that. Development is obviously a game of returns. You simply can't get the same rents that you can get on the northwest side than you can get downtown. but the cost of construction is going to be the same. I mean, obviously there's different levels of quality that you can have in finishes with apartments, but it's still, especially now with rising construction costs and how difficult it is to get projects off the ground these days, it's increasingly difficult to build affordable housing, to build a housing that is really needed in some of these areas. One trend that we were seeing in Milwaukee in general is just smaller developments are having a really hard time getting off the ground. Average development sizes have really increased over the past few years, more so because we have seen fewer of these smaller developments. You know, developers are going bigger. They're starting to attract, starting to target some of that more luxury demographic. That's just the state of the economy that we're in right now. You know, the construction prices are so high, and it's just getting increasingly difficult to build some of these projects. So, you know, going bigger, going grander is really what's fueling a lot of the development right now.
What does this say about where investment and development is going in the city?
I think any development that we see downtown is going to be good for the city overall. Overall, we do want to see more development on the Northwest side. I think one thing that, you know, we can do as a city, especially from the city's perspective, is to really start to build more themselves out there and really start to lead the way. When we talk about infrastructure improvements, doing streetscaping, improving the pedestrian environment, for example, doing all that stuff downtown is great. The new Riverwalk additions are great and all that, but we have to make those same developments on the Northwest side as well. And hopefully that will attract the development. But again, one thing, as you mentioned with the freeway, really decimated a lot of the Northwest side, and it really hasn't recovered yet. And you know, development ultimately is just like any business. It has to be profitable. And especially with construction prices that we've been seeing these days. But again, one thing we really need in Milwaukee is affordable housing everywhere. We don't just need affordable housing on the Northwest side. We need affordable housing downtown. We need affordable housing in Bayview. We need affordable housing where a lot of the jobs and the greater opportunities are, especially as well as the transit connections. You know, downtown is really the hub of transportation connection for the entire metro. You know, it makes it easy to get, you know, bus lines out to business parks and suburbs. You know, we have the new BRT line that's going from downtown basically to the medical college and Milwaukee County Research Park. So to get more affordable housing downtown where it's needed is really going to help the whole city as a whole.
Talking to the urbanist side of GUARD and thinking about how we can reimagine Milwaukee and reimagine our urban landscape here in the city specifically, and thinking about how we can fill unused areas, largely unfilled areas, whether it be parking garages, car lots, piece of land that is just unused. How could we use these majority unfilled areas? How can we make them more people-centered and more community-centered?
We do have a lot of parking lots downtown, but what that map was really looking at was just parking only uses, right? So if there was an office tower with a parking pedestal beneath it, you know, 5 or 6 floors of parking underneath it, I didn't include that, right? So that was really only looking at parking specific properties, right? So if we have a parking lot, parking garage with no other uses, I see that as a problem for downtown. You know, we have so much demand for apartments, and there's so much that we can do to improve the pedestrian and urban experience that, you know, we really should be looking at making these as mixed use, as vibrant as possible. So I think the city has a lot of opportunity to kind of divest of some of these properties, same as some of our institutions, and really looking at making these more equitable developments for all Milwaukeeans.
Well, GUARD, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect. I really appreciate you being here today. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Mallory.
GUARD Pecor is a senior market analyst at CoStar Group. He spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang. Road safety is one of the top issues facing Milwaukeeans today. Reckless driving has been on the rise, endangering pedestrians, cyclists, and drivers themselves. The City of Milwaukee is looking at a number of solutions, including reinvigorating driver education programs, but one of the main solutions is looking at the streets themselves, improving street design to help guide drivers to behave more responsibly. Robert Schneider is a professor of urban planning at UW-Milwaukee, and he joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to explain how reimagining streets can save lives.
So I think any Milwaukeean can confidently say we have an issue with reckless driving in the city. And the solutions around this are pretty varied, but one of the most popular and seemingly most effective is this idea of redesigning streets to discourage this kind of reckless driving. How effective can redesigning a street be in curbing bad driving?
Yeah, the engineering solutions, as we call them, with redesigning streets are one part of the broader idea of how to make traffic safety even better in this city of Milwaukee, but in many cities across the country that are facing similar issues. There's a broader movement called Vision Zero that actually originated in Sweden and has spread to the United States, and thinking about not being willing to accept the death toll that we see on our nation and our communities' highways and streets. We shouldn't accept a system that we've developed that does result in people dying simply trying to cross the street or simply driving to the grocery store. We need to have a transportation system that's safer. Engineering is one of those strategies to address how streets are designed to make the interactions between different roadway users safer, because it reduces the speed that people travel on any given street. If you imagine a street that has four lanes and a higher speed limit and, you know, very wide lanes that people just feel like they can drive very fast on, versus a much narrower two-lane street that may have things like curb extensions or median islands to help provide more access for pedestrians to cross it. Maybe it has bike lanes or even protected bike lanes that are on the other side of on-street parking or raised up from the roadway surface at the sidewalk level. All those types of pedestrian or bicycle facilities on a narrower roadway can make drivers feel like they should be driving slower. So it's just natural to be driving at a slower speed. And the slower speed ultimately leads to lower impact crashes, which lead to less injury when the crash would in fact happen.
So you've mentioned a few of the different methods that we can use on streets to make them a bit safer through engineering. What are some of the other things cities utilize in creating safer driving conditions?
Yeah, so I'd like to get into a little bit more detail about this. The idea of making a street safer through design, I mentioned the importance of speed. There are a variety of ways to ultimately have vehicles traveling a slightly slower speed down the street. One way is by reducing the number of travel lanes on some of our main thoroughfares. And that can, of course, slow down travel speeds, but also make it easier for pedestrians to cross the street. They have fewer number of lanes to negotiate. And even people turning onto and off of the street or bicyclists crossing the street benefit from that too. Another way to consider is a reduction in speed limit. One idea that's been considered at the city level is to make residential streets not 25 miles an hour, but in fact, 20 miles an hour. So just the idea of a lower speed limit for any neighborhood street. And then lowering the speed limits on some of the arterial streets, the main thoroughfares within the city, maybe instead of 30 miles an hour, 25 miles an hour. These types of changes work a lot better if they're complemented by changes in design, one of which, you know, I mentioned the reduction in travel lanes. Curb extensions is a very important additional type of treatment that's being used. And the city has a number of these on both main thoroughfares and some of the more local streets. What curb extensions do is they narrow the street right at an intersection location where a crosswalk would be. They may narrow it by 6 to 8 feet on either side of the street. So essentially you're narrowing the pedestrian crossing distance by about 15 feet. And that helps with the pedestrian crossing, but at the same time, it makes the street visually narrower. So that helps the driver see a space that doesn't seem as inviting to speed. It also helps prevent what we have a serious problem with here in Milwaukee, which is drivers passing other drivers on the right side in the parking lane or in the bike lane. So curb extensions can help prevent that. And one of the reasons why drivers passing on the right side in bike lanes or in the curb lanes is so dangerous is because if a pedestrian does happen to be crossing in the crosswalk, it's very hard to see somebody who's passing in that location because the other cars are in the regular travel lane. So it creates what's called a multiple threat situation. The other benefit of the curve extension, of course, is if a driver is turning a corner, they have to take that turning speed much more slowly and carefully than if the corner does not have a curb extension. It's pretty easy to drive fast around a right turn if there is a very wide turning radius. I think it's important to point out too that these types of infrastructure changes, especially curb extensions, are places that can be opportunities to beautify a street, not just make it safer, but make it more attractive. One of the things that the city has done with their rapid implementation projects, an example on the near west side on North 27th Street, the Department of Public Works worked with the near west side partners to add planter boxes. They've got flowers in them and they've got the near west side partners logo within the curb extension area. So there's delineator posts, white posts that stand up about 3 feet high. And then just inside those is where the planters are. And so it's beautifying the street at the same time as helping to slow traffic and make it safer.
As you mentioned, we're already seeing some examples of these different methods being implemented around the city you just mentioned, North 27th Street. What are some of the areas of the city where we're already seeing these put in place?
Yeah, so there's a number of applications besides North 27th Street. Over the last 5 or so years, the city has made changes to corridors where they've used these flexible delineator posts. And those are a temporary way of testing whether or not a thing like a curb extension or a lane change, seeing if those will actually work and doing a test before putting in more permanent infrastructure. So they call those rapid implementation projects. And so some examples are on Holly Road on the west side, the Locust Street Bridge between River West and the Murray Hill neighborhood. There's changes that have been done on South 13th Street on the south side. Within neighborhoods, Galena Street is a location that at first had an active street, which essentially closed the street to through cars, but opened it up to people who wanted to walk on the street itself, bike on the street for neighborhood gatherings. They could use that street, but cars were prohibited from going through. So as a part of that active streets project, Galena started to become a place where they experimented with a temporary traffic circle on one of the intersections. They put in a few different types of curb extensions. They also put in temporary speed humps on certain blocks. And so anybody who wants to see what those look like, they can go to Galena Street just to the east of Washington Park and take that between Washington Park and Tiefenthaler Park to see some of those options. And that's a great example that other neighborhood leaders, residents could look at and say, hey, you know, maybe some of these types of treatments to help slow traffic and help encourage walking and biking activity could be used in my neighborhood too.
All right, well, we will see what the future holds. Bob, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thanks for having me, Joy.
Robert Schneider is a professor of urban planning at UW-Milwaukee, and he spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. At WUWM.com, you can find more of our coverage of Milwaukee's reckless driving problem. Coming up later in the show, astronomy contributor Jean Creighton joins us to share the mythology behind the Cancer Zodiac.
This seemed to be a somewhat unfortunate scheme because all Hercules had to do was step on the crab, and that was the end of that. And Hera felt that this was an unfortunate way to repay the creature that was willing to help her, so she put the crab up in the sky to honor it.
But first, two local realtors join us to share the current outlook of the summer housing market, what trends are staying, and what signs of progress they're seeing that could indicate buyers are having more leverage. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Like a Fact on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've gone through the process of buying a home in the past few years, or even simply tried to recently, you've seen that it is still very much a seller's market, and a difficult one for buyers. High demand for houses, partially sparked by the pandemic, and low inventory has resulted in the average price for homes to skyrocket. The median price for a single-family home is $275,000, according to a May 2022 Wisconsin Housing Report. With inflation increasing and interest rates rising, many potential buyers are wondering if the summer housing market affordability will continue to be out of range. There's hopes that eventually the demand pressure will reduce the seller's advantage. And to gain more insight on the current market, I'm joined by two local realtors. Tina Balaka is a managing broker with Shore West Realtors, and Courtney Stefaniak is a third-generation realtor with the Stefaniak Group. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
So what are the fundamentals of the current housing market in the greater Milwaukee area right now?
I think a common one, which we've been talking about for a while, is the lack of inventory and just the great supply of buyers that we have. So just not enough homes for sale to meet demand right now.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. It has been a tremendous struggle the last few years, but certainly we felt the shortage when COVID hit, and it really just accelerated what we were seeing in the market of that lack of inventory and the level of competition and the struggles that buyers have had to get a home is something that we have never seen before in our history of real estate. And so we've been faced with a lot of challenges, certainly for sellers. They have been in a fantastic position with having growth of values in their homes at an unprecedented rate. And so a lot of sellers have really been in the driver's seat in a lot of our transactions. So change will be subtle as it's coming, but certainly looking forward to a little bit of a more balance in our marketplace.
As you said, this has been going on for the past few years, and it seems that housing prices have continued to be really high, with most getting, say, $10,000 or $20,000 over asking, which is already at a much higher mark than the house's assessed value. And I think a lot of potential buyers out there are wondering if something's got to give. So what have been your observations, like both on the independent firm side with you, Courtney, and on the larger scale at Shore West, Tina?
Yeah, I mean, we've definitely seen a shift, but it's been a very slow shift. So I think we usually see, you know, a few more listings in the summertime, and prices are still continuing to rise, but they're doing so at a slower rate. We're still seeing listings with multiple offers, but I feel like the interest rate spike has calmed things down slightly. It's still very competitive. It's still a seller's market, but it's not as chaotic as the beginning of this year or even last year, where we were seeing 10, 15, 20, sometimes 30 offers on a property. So that interest rate spike has shifted things slightly, but it's not slowing buyers down.
And from what I'm seeing from our perspective is very similar to Courtney. I mean, when we think about, you know, different size firms, it's really, we're all realtors in it together, helping our clients as we navigate. Right now for buyers, it's also that we're starting to see where they can maybe have an inspection again. I saw some radon testing recently, which was something I probably hadn't seen in an offer in a few years. So we're starting to subtly see some changes in the approach that buyers are able to take when they submit their offers, where before it was, they were giving so much in order to get a house. They were waiving inspections, they were waiving testing, they were having appraisal gaps in their offers. So we're starting to see where they can start introducing maybe some more contingencies back in, which really is healthy in a market, because it should not be so skewed one way or the other. So I'm hoping that it will kind of create a little bit more of a level playing field. Buyers certainly will still have to pay the fair market value. That's not going to change if they are in a competitive situation. We are still seeing that, but as Courtney said, it might not be those 30-20s. It might be 5-10. It all depends on the house, the location, the condition. That's going to drive what buyers are going to do for those particular homes.
As you mentioned, Courtney, with the interest rates going up and inflation keeps on rising, and the Fed recently delivered its biggest interest rate hike in decades to try and combat this. So do you think the economic slowdown will impact housing, or do you think it'll continue to be a very slow shift, even though people are really feeling the immediate effects of what they're facing economically?
Right. I think it's still going to be a slow shift. There has to be a correction at some point, but we talk about economic recession and inflation, that doesn't automatically equate to a housing crisis, right? So everyone's asking, like, is there a bubble? Is the market going to crash? We're not seeing that. If more inventory came to market, we could absorb that inventory. We have enough buyer demand out there to absorb extra inventory. So I don't foresee that being the situation here. And when people talk about that, you know, compare, they think of 2008. We're not comparing apples to oranges there. We have much stricter lending regulations than we do in 2008. People have a lot more equity in their homes. So I think the comparisons are not exactly direct when we talk about today's situation. Today is more supply and demand, which is driving up our prices. So even though there might be a correction, there might be a slow shift, I don't foresee home prices going down. I think they're just going to continue to accelerate, but at a slower rate.
Let's talk about the makeup of the demographics of the majority of buyers right now. Tina, what are you observing here?
We still have a pretty strong pool of first-time buyers that are entering the market, and they're weighing those options of, okay, do I continue to rent? Rates have gone up, but historically, rates are still very low, so they're still taking advantage of that opportunity to jump into homeownership. We have seen a little bit of a struggle where someone has a house to sell and then they need to buy something because that house that they want to buy might not be there and they need the equity from their home in order to purchase. As things start to subtly shift, we might see some buyers who are willing to do a home sale contingency potentially, but depending on the competition that they're up against in the home they're looking at, they'll have to weigh out those options. So it's generally a lot of first-time home buyers are those who maybe want to downsize. They want to take advantage of the equity that they've had in their home. And maybe it's reevaluating, do they need the size that they currently have, and then take that equity and go into something a little smaller.
So you mentioned it's very much a seller's market, but is it as straightforward as that? Like, what kind of challenges are sellers facing right now?
I think I run into a lot of sellers, or a lot of, potential sellers, because they want to take advantage of the market. They want to sell their home. However, then they think of, okay, where am I going to go? Do I want to jump into the buyer pool right now and be on that end of things? So I feel like that's a challenge for a lot of potential sellers in this market, is they'd love to get the equity out of their home and maybe downsize or move to a condo, get a second home, whatever the case may be. But do they want to jump in the buyer pool and compete with everyone else? So I think that's a challenge. I don't know, Tina, what are you seeing from some of your sellers?
Similarly, and that has been some of the holdback in bringing inventory to the market, because there are individuals who may want to sell their home, but it's that plan B. Where do we go? So that has created a little bit of a stall in bringing some of the much needed inventory that we need. So agents have had to really be strategic when they're in conversations and customizing a plan that could work for that individual. A lot of sellers have had to potentially sell their home, go into a rental, stay there for a while until they can find their next home, or sell the home, stay there for a few months, get free occupancy or low cost occupancy from the buyer until they make that next move. So strategy definitely comes into play in trying to make things as seamless as possible, but it's definitely a challenge in trying to make things seamless at times.
So we're talking about, you know, an end in sight that might not be as close as people want or may be thinking. But in your opinions, what are the trends that we'd see that show it's, quote, back to normal, like pre-COVID, pre-high demand? What's an average listing time, pricing, you know, what buyers and sellers can both get?
Yeah, I think, you know, we're still seeing homes get multiple offers within 24 to 48 hours on market. So it's still a strong seller's market in that sense. And at the same time, yes, rates have gone up slightly. However, when you look at the history of interest rates, 5 to 6% is still a very good rate. You know, I have people in my office who've been in this business for 40 plus years. And when they bought their first house, their interest rate was 18%. So when we talk about 5 or 5.5, it's still a pretty good rate when you look at the bigger picture.
And when we think about the signs of change, things that we kind of look at are days on market. So if we start seeing days on market, I had a few agents like, it's been on the market 10 days. We haven't had an offer. I'm like, it's okay. That is still pretty good. And it could be in the past, a balanced market might be 30, 60 days on the market before there'd be an offer, you know, having that balance where you could actually have a conversation about negotiations. When we talk in terms of, there's a phrase that we use called months of inventory. And months of inventory basically is how long would it take to clear off all of our inventory? And we have been so lean with inventory that it's like less than a month of inventory because everything goes so quickly. A balanced market generally, shockingly, is actually a 5 to 6 months of inventory. And we're way far from that. So it could take years to really get to a true balance because these things just don't happen overnight. But those are some of the things that we kind of gauge: days on market, months of inventory, supply, to kind of trigger, and then the acceleration of prices. So they've gone up so fast, so dramatically, but as we start monitoring, you know, the remainder of 2022, each month, is that accelerating? Is it slowing down? It's certainly going to continue to go up, but at what pace?
Tina Balaka is a managing broker with Shore West Realtors in their Greenfield location. Courtney Stefaniak is a third-generation realtor in the Milwaukee area with the Stefaniak Group. You can find the link to the full Wisconsin Housing Report at WUWM.com. Did you know that you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Well, if you'd like to take us on the go or hear any of the segments on the show, just search for Lake Effect in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts to listen to us on demand. You can also follow WUWM on Instagram, where you'll find videos and pictures from news stories and Lake Effect interviews. Next, we'll learn about the astronomy and mythology behind the zodiac Cancer with contributor Gene Creighton. That's ahead on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Do you know your zodiac sign? Would you know how to find it in the night sky? Well, to help us learn about the astronomy and mythology behind the zodiac, I'm joined by Lake Effect astronomy contributor Gene Creighton, director of UW-Milwaukee's Manfred Olson Planetarium. The planetarium has been hosting a new series of events based on the zodiac, and this month they're highlighting Cancer. Gene Creighton, welcome back to Lake Effect. Good to see you again.
Lovely to see you, Audrey.
So this month's zodiac is Cancer that the planetarium is highlighting. To start, where is Cancer in the night sky and what does it look like to our eyes?
So Cancer is going to be between Leo and Gemini, the twins. In fact, I probably should have said that the other way. But in any case, those two are bright. The twins have two really bright stars that are side by side, similar in brightness, and Leo I describe as a backward question mark. So in between those two pretty bright things, there is a patch of sky that you need to look at for a little bit. One way of describing it is to imagine a peace symbol without the circle. So those three triangles stuck together, that's what makes cancer or the crab. And it is one of those somewhat faint constellations. So you need to kind of give your eyes some time to adjust to the darkness.
So when is it visible in the night sky, at least to us in our hemisphere?
It would be a nice thing to look at late in the winter, early in the spring. Right now, the sun is too close to it. So even though, you know, many people are celebrating their birthday as Cancers, they should not anticipate that they'll be able to see their constellation.
Yeah, it's kind of counterintuitive, but we do have to remind ourselves, just because it's your birthday season and in the zodiac, it doesn't mean you're going to be able to see it at the time of your birthday.
Your present is a few months before or after, like outside your birthday. That's when you'll have a nice time to see Cancer the Crab.
So when it comes to Cancer the Crab, what is the mythology behind it? Why is it known as a crab?
Okay, are you ready?
Yes, story time.
Storytelling time, yes. So the story is connected to the myth, the superhero of Hercules. And Hercules, as you perhaps remember, had dealt with all kinds of monsters in his labors. He had 12 labors. And one of the labors, he was assigned to kill Hydra. Now, and in particular, in Greek, we say Lernaea Hydra, because there were different Hydras, different monsters. And Hydra comes from the word Ithor, which means water. So this was a water monster that waited by the water hole. And as often these creatures have multiple heads. And then they would just sit there and wait until some unsuspecting animal comes for water, and they would snatch it, right? So it was asked of Hercules to go find the Lernaea Hydra and kill it. Well, as it turns out, this monster was tricky, because when you cut one of its heads, you got two. So this was the original two for one special. And poor Hercules had to swallow his pride. This was the one of the 12 labors. This was the one that he needed help. So his nephew showed up, and Hercules would cut one of the heads, of which there were nine, and the nephew would burn the stub so that it couldn't regenerate. It couldn't make the two heads. Now, because Hercules got help, the goddess Ida, Hera in English, had it in for Hercules, because this was the son of Zeus, but not her son. So she wanted at all costs to bump off Hercules. And she thought that if he gets help, then the Hydra should get help. So she sent a crab to bite Hercules and distract him. And the hope was that that might give Hydra the advantage. This seemed to be a somewhat unfortunate scheme, because all Hercules had to do was step on the crab, and that was the end of that. And Hera felt that this was an unfortunate way to repay the creature that was willing to help her, so she put the crab up in the sky to honor it. And that's the story of how Cancer the Crab got to be in the sky.
So putting him up there to honor him, but he still technically failed the mission, so he gets a lower, dimmer spot in the night sky. Is that right?
Maybe. That's right. Maybe it didn't get very bright stars. Yes. But some acknowledgement is there.
Definitely. So when it comes to other objects within Cancer, are there any deep sky objects that make this constellation special?
Yes. And one could argue it's not particularly deep sky, in that you can't see it with the naked eye if you're in a dark place. I mean, really dark place. So, in fact, if you look at the three triangles coming together, somewhere in the middle, it looks like your eye is playing a trick, that there's some sort of fuzziness there. That is what we call the beehive cluster. And if you have a modest pair of binoculars, you will be able to determine, there's a bunch of stars here. And what I like to say about this is an open, what we call an open cluster. And it's only, and I quote, only 625 million years old, which sounds ridiculous, right? How can you say this is a fairly young group of stars? But if you put it in the context of an average person's life is 80 years, you would say that the equivalent for the Beehive is 4. So this is a fairly young group of stars. And as I said, it is visible with keen eyes and a pair of binoculars even better. So that's worth looking into.
Well, thank you for joining me today to share more about the Cancer Zodiac.
This was great fun. Thank you, Audrey.
Jean Creighton is our regular astronomy contributor and the director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium at UW-Milwaukee. Their live interactive show, Constellations of the Zodiac, Cancer, takes place tomorrow evening. Lake Park is a popular place to visit during the summer months here in Milwaukee. And today we're going to share a bit of history about the North Point Lighthouse that's there. Earlier this year, I spoke with Anita Petrikowski, a volunteer guide and author at Forest Home Cemetery, about Georgia Green Stebbins. Stebbins is the longest-running lighthouse keeper at the North Shore Lighthouse. And Petrikowski shares more about her work and legacy. We have someone who is intricately tied to one of Milwaukee's landmarks, the North Point Lighthouse. So can you share more about Georgia Green Stebbins?
Yes, happy to. Georgia Green Stebbins was born in 1846 and died in 1921. And she has an amazing life story. She was the keeper of North Point Lighthouse for 33 years. Georgia was actually born in New York and was living in New York with her husband when she contracted tuberculosis. And her doctor said, "You need to leave New York City and find a place where the air is cool and fresh so that you can improve your health." Well, she came to Milwaukee where her father, Daniel Green, was the lighthouse keeper. He actually was appointed lighthouse keeper in 1871. So when she arrived in 1874 and she came to the lighthouse, she found both her father and her mother were in ill health. He was unable to perform his duties. So without hesitation, Georgia stepped up. She started doing the duties and the responsibilities of the lighthouse keeper, and did so for the next 7 years during her father's term. In 1881, then Georgia was appointed the official lighthouse keeper of North Point Lighthouse and served for 26 years in that capacity. So in total, 33 years as the lighthouse keeper at Milwaukee's North Point Lighthouse.
It's very impressive, and I imagine it wasn't common for any lighthouse in the country to be run by a woman at this time. So what kind of duties and tasks did Georgia dedicate her life to?
Well, in addition to maintaining her home, because she did have a child, she had Albert, and he was born right there. She never took a vacation, but the things that she did is, especially during the winter, every 4 hours, she had to climb the lighthouse tower. And she was responsible for filling the canisters with oil, trimming the wick, cleaning the windows, winding the mechanism so that the light at the top of the lighthouse would continue to burn all night long. And she did that every 4 hours. So it was amazing until an electric light was installed in 1909. But she did that faithfully without leaving her post. She also had to maintain records. So she recorded the passing of ships. If there were boats in distress, she informed the Coast Guard. And so all of those records and that information actually is still maintained in the North Point Lighthouse Museum. And you can see those kinds of things that she had while she was a lighthouse keeper there at the museum today.
Anita Petrikowski is a volunteer and guide at Forest Home Cemetery here in Milwaukee. She's also the author of the historic women chapter of the book, Milwaukee's Forest Home Cemetery. We spoke in March, and you can learn about other notable women who are buried at Forest Home at WUWM.com. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Joy Powers and Mallory Chang join me in producing Lake Effect each week with help from Chase Browning and Kobe Brown. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. We also heard from Mayan Silver and Taryn Powell from the WUWM news team this week. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager. Valeria Navarro-Viegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. Join us again on Monday at noon to learn how a spongy moth is eating away at trees in southeast Wisconsin and what we can do about it. Plus, we'll speak with the author of The Dog Lover's Guide to Hiking Wisconsin State Parks about which outdoor spots are best for bringing along your furry friend. If you've missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. And remember, if you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast from Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.